ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yeah, the underpinnings of the modern financial system may not be exactly sexy, but they're certainly important. My next guest, Stuart Kells, is the author of many books on a wide range of subjects. His shorter works have been published around the world, including in the Smithsonian, the Paris Review, the Guardian, and so on. He's an adjunct professor at La Trobe's University Business School, and over recent times he spent many hours digging into the financial basement, getting his head around interbank payment systems, foreign exchange settlement arrangements, the fine print of derivatives contracts. We'll spare you that, I think. And the normally unseen workings of banks and trading platforms. And he's particularly dug into payment systems and the design of financial markets and whether or not we could have a better payment system. It led to a famous court case in the US involving the Alice Corporation and CLS, which we'll talk about as well. That's the title of his latest book. But he joins us to discuss the money system, the banking system, and what is money anyway? Stuart, good evening to you. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Phil. Great to be here.
It's great to have you with us as well. I played that Jimmy Stewart thing, James, first up, because I think that's how most people would, and reasonably so. I mean, people aren't stupid, but I think most people, when they think about borrowing money from a bank, assume that the bank's got money to lend you. Otherwise, how could they lend it to you? And that what you're borrowing is money that the bank has, and then they give it to you as a loan with interest, and you repay it back. And when you repay it back, it goes into a box somewhere in the bank, and they've got that money back, and then they could lend it to someone else, and round it goes. Turns out that's actually not how the system works at all, is it?
That's right, it's not. It's important to distinguish between the different kinds of money. As you know, there's you know, banknotes and coins, which are becoming less and less important.
Just, let's put that to one side for a second. Yeah, the issue of cash, because obviously cash exists. I've got a $50 bill here.
Yes.
That exists. But my loan is really just an entry on my bank statement electronically, isn't it?
That's right. So talking about bank deposit money, which is by far the most important type of money, you're right. There's a common way of thinking about it and the way people write about it, which is that you put money into your account and you sort of imagine that you have this thing called your account that has money in it, and that when you make a transfer, you picture it moving between accounts or between banks.
Yeah.
And when you pay taxes, you imagine it moving. You know, we talk about this as the metaphor of the government coffers. There's some idea that the government is collecting taxation. And when we're buying things overseas, we picture our money, you know, going from here to potentially a foreign account or being swapped for a foreign currency. And all of these ideas, as you indicated, are, you know, the basis for this concept of fractional reserve banking, which is the idea that this sort of mobile and persistent form of money is collected by banks. Either they receive deposits or they, you know, borrow from the wholesale market, something like that, and then they turn that into loans.
That's right. I think apart from smart people like you and others on the inside, I think that's how most people believe the banking system works.
Yes,
in fact, we're often told by politicians, aren't we, that, you know, the national economy is just like a home economy, and, you know, you've got to save money and tighten your belt and all this stuff, all of which turns out to be rubbish.
Correct.
The bank can actually, how about this, get your head around this one. The bank can lend you money that they don't actually have at all, never did have.
Well, that's right.
They can create money out of thin air simply by saying they've got it, can't they?
Well, not only can they only create loans that way.
That's all they do.
Yes, that's right. So there's this idea that they're repurposing deposits into loans. That doesn't happen. But it's important first to understand the nature of this sort of money, right? Yeah. In your account, there is no money over and above the account balance. The balance is a record of an IOU from the bank to you. It's a liability for the bank. It's not an asset. And they can't, you know, in a sense, repurpose it into a loan, which would be an asset for them. So instead, what happens is the loans come first. They write a credit amount, and that has all sorts of connotations. It means that they have obligations to provide that amount at your direction. They have to settle payments relating to that. And they have an asset themselves, which is the future flow of repayments and
Hang
interest.
On. Let me put this in simple terms. If the bank's got $10...
Well, they don't start with money at all. There's no money at the start. It's nil. It's a
blank
sheet.
Yeah, they have, because I just gave them $10, right? So they've got $10. There's $10 in the bank because I put it there.
You have a $10 balance in your account. Yeah, yep. There's no money besides the balance.
Well, I gave it to the bank. I passed over a $10 bill across the counter. They've got it. I haven't got it anymore, so they've got it.
Well, the $10 note's gone off somewhere else, and that becomes a settlement unit. But you have an account of a balance of $10. That's
but
right.
Here's the thing that I'm struggling to get my head around, and that is the bank can lend that $10 to someone else.
No, they can't.
Why not?
They don't. They can't, and they don't. Well, as I said, it's a liability back to you. They have an obligation to follow your instructions in relation to payments of that.
Just pursue. Just take me with you on. Hold my hand on this one for a second. That's all the assets the bank has at the moment is $10, right? I think
it's not an asset for the bank.
Okay, but if the bank wants to lend money, they can lend the next person in the queue. They can lend them $10, but then they could lend the next 10 people in the queue $10, even though they don't have that money to lend as such.
Once you get down into the bowels of banking, it's a brain-bending space. You need to leave all your assumptions at the door and you need to start again, right? Everyone needs to start again. So when the bank's creating a loan, right, say they're lending someone some money for a house or a car or something, say it's $100,000, the loan balance, so say they have to credit an account that loan balance, they credit that out of thin air, the $100,000, right? Mm. Two things happen at that particular moment. The $100,000's there in the loan account for you to then pay to someone or to keep some of it in an offset and pay the rest, right? But also there's a corresponding asset for the bank, which is their expectation
that I'll pay it back.
That you'll pay it back. So those two things happen. They're created anew. They're not created from existing money or balances or anything like that.
But how can bank – hang on. This is the thing I don't quite get, and I'm sure lots of people don't. How can banks do this? I can't do that. I can't do that to you, Stuart. I can't say to you, Stuart, here's $100,000. Now you owe me that money and put it into your and create a credit in your account because I can't do that. Why? Because I don't have a banking license?
That's a really important part of it. The first part is you can't do it because you're not a bank. The second part of it is that this is another part of the banking system that's not well understood. We have essentially a two-tier system of banking that happens in monetarily sovereign countries like Australia and the US and the UK and Japan and Sweden, which involves what are called exchange settlement accounts. So these are balances that the commercial banks hold with the central bank. And when they have to make interbank payments and transfers, they are settled, sometimes in net, part of them in net terms, but they're settled using these central bank balances. So in a sense, the money that you and I are using is almost like B-grade money, which is the bank, ordinary bank account money. But this exchange settlement account type funds is the good stuff. So as I said, they hold these accounts with the central bank, and that allows them to settle payments. So one of the reasons why you can't make those loans to your friends is because you don't have access to the exchange settlement account fund. So you could make the promise, but you wouldn't be able to fulfill it.
It's completely weird.
It's very weird.
I mean, it's completely weird. See, I think most people don't think. I would think most people would think a bank's got money, but they don't.
Well, there's all sorts of implications from that, right? Just stay with me for one second, right? So people think of fractional reserve banking, right? We've touched on that as being false. Hmm. But they also think about bank runs, right? This idea of a bank run. So everyone suddenly wants their deposits out of the bank.
They all want their money back, yeah.
Yep, because in a sense, that's a problem because in this picture we all have, the deposits have been lent out to other customers into loans, right? Mm-hmm. If that's not true, then the deposits, in a sense, are still there, and they are. A bank can't go broke specifically in relation to a run on deposits these days in the system we have, this two-tier system we have, because the deposits are a liability for the bank. The deposits aren't the basis for loans, and in some ways they're sort of a costly nuisance for the bank. So if you lost all the deposits, just thinking about them deposits on their own, that is not a problem for the bank. Where the problem enters is in order to fulfill that outflow of deposits, the bank has to have adequate exchange settlement account funds, which are these special Uber funds.
This is right? money that they've parked with the Reserve Bank.
These are these special interbank payment tokens. It's not really they're not really money, but they're settlement units with the central bank. That's right. In order to fulfill the outflow, they need to have enough of these ESAs. So the bank doesn't actually go broke because of the outflow of deposits, but it can get into difficulty if it doesn't have enough of these
ESAs.
There must
be a relationship between the two, though, isn't there, surely?
There definitely is. And so sometimes the inflow of deposits can bring these ESAs, and that's a way that banks can get these settlement units. But they can also just be, in an emergency, they can be gifted them by the central bank, or they can buy them or acquire them on the wholesale market through all sorts of different kinds of arrangements.
You see, when you start thinking like this, you think, well, hang on, banking is an extremely precarious business. Because a lot of people might think, gee, you know, how could you go broke running a bank? Because you bring in money and pay 2%, and you lend it out at 4%. I mean, any dummy could make money out of that.
Well, that's right. And thinking about money differently, it actually seems once you get into it, it's actually nowhere near as risky or precarious as we thought. Right? There isn't this intermingling of deposits and loans.
No.
You can't go broke because of the deposit side. You can go broke because of the ESAs, and then the loans are essentially the bank making a judgment about the credit worthiness of the borrower, right? And that's essentially their business. But once we start thinking differently about this, it has all sorts of other connotations and other sorts of implications around
regulation.
Okay,
I'm a big bookmaker, Stuart, and sure. I got a lot of cash. And it's the Melbourne Cup weekend, and over the last week I've got $25 million bucks worth of cash because I bet with big punters, right?
Nice.
And of course it is, but I'm not going to keep it under my bed where I normally keep it because there are people after me. So I take it and I put it in a bank. Mm-hmm. But it's banknotes. I've got banknotes, 25 million of them.
Mm-hmm.
I give that to the bank. What's that? That's a thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes. And you're not necessarily going to have that in your account, though. Depends on what the rules are with the bank. As you know, some banks are limiting cash withdrawals,
deposits, though.
They generally don't limit cash deposits,
correct.
Although there may be some money laundering rules which trigger a red light when you show up with $25 million worth of cash.
No, it's all documented. I've got big punters, you know, Kerry Packer and all these people. I've got a lot of them, you know. And so it's all above board. I put the $25 million bucks in cash. I bring it in some Gladstone bags, in some big plastic bags.
Yes.
Pass it over the counter. That's a thing. That's money, isn't it?
But it's not going to be used as a basis for a loan, right? If someone's creating a loan in the bank, they're
What's
not going to
What's the bank do with that money?
Several different kinds of things. As I said, they'll go off into a central area where they'll use it for processing withdrawals into cash. Mm-hmm. Some of it may end up going back to the central bank and for other purposes. The actual amount of physical money that we have in the system is not huge, and it's shrinking, as you know.
But here's the thing that's hard to get your head around too. See, you put your money in the bank, it's not necessarily the case that the bank could ever pay it back to you, is it?
That's right. If there are limits on cash withdrawals, for example, you could have put your $25 million in, and then you show up next day and say, "I'd like to take $20 million out," and they say, "Well,
we don't have it.
$10,000."
Yeah, we don't have it. We don't have the have $25 million anymore because we haven't been going so well.
Well, a serious element of this is this idea, particularly in the US, of unbanked people. So people who don't have access to the banking system. So not only do they have restrictions on cash withdrawals, but they have restrictions on, you know, on what basis you can get a bank account. And if it becomes more and more the case that bank money is the money and you're excluded from the banking system, then you're essentially limited to the fringes of the banking system. So, you know, payday lenders and loan sharks and things like that, if you ever want to bank a government check or something like that. So this has real consequences for equity.
Yeah. Garth from Everton makes a good point. He says, Phil, interesting conversation. See, I'm still trying to get my head around all this. Phil, I don't understand why banks talk about funding, i.e. wholesale funding or deposit funding, which implies that the bank borrows deposits to then on-lend to customers, doesn't it?
That sort of language is is very common, and it's not an accurate reflection and it of implies, how the banks work.
It basically implies that, I mean, to simplify it, that the bank sends around a truck and gets cash from one place and brings it round to their place. I mean, okay, they do it electronically, but it's still a thing. And, you know, when they didn't have 50 million, but one day they have it the next because they got it from somewhere else. But that's what they say they do, don't they?
If it's not about acquiring these exchange settlement account funds, then they do not need deposits or wholesale funding in order to create loans.
So in other words, they create loans. See, this is alarming people. They create loans out of thin air.
Correct. And yeah, here's another brain bender for you.
Wow.
When you use your bank account money to pay your tax, the government does not collect that money. It vaporizes at that particular moment. So taxation is a money destruction process, not a money collection process.
When a government sends you a tax bill, they've just created that tax bill out of thin air. And when you send them the money, it just cancels that thin air transaction out.
Not really. That's similar, but it's a little bit backwards. So the obligation that you have to pay tax to the government is a real thing, and that's an asset for the government. But when you use your bank account money to pay that obligation, that's the end of it. The money doesn't go into it's not held as money by the government. The government will make an accounting entry of that money, but essentially that's a fiscal contrivance. The government isn't holding that money. That money disappears at that particular moment of payment. And the same thing when the government borrows. This is even more, this is brain-bending squared. When the government borrows, such as by selling a bond, that's temporary money destruction. And what I mean by that is that the money's destroyed at the moment when you pay for the bond, but then it's recreated later for interest payments and for paying the face value of the bond.
So it's all just fiction. It doesn't actually exist.
It's layers and layers of fiction. Wow. The government coffers, you hear this all the time in public finance about
you hear about these coffers. I mean, there are no coffers and there's nothing in them.
And this is where it gets even more interesting, right? So we have this idea that there's this fiscal budget constraint, that the government has to raise enough money in order to pay for defence and services and other things.
They say it all the time, Stuart.
All the time. And that's it's sort of true, but the constraint is not a structural one around the use of money. The constraint is partly a self-constraint, which is this contrivance of this internal accounting, but it's also more substantively an inflation constraint. Because the government is creating money when they spend, private banks are creating money when they lend, and in different ways, the central bank is also creating money. So you have all these different sources of money creation in the economy. If that gets out of control, you have inflation, right? And sometimes you can have excessive inflation, as we've had recently.
Let's continue talking about this, because I think I'm beginning to grab it. Stuart Kells is my guest, but we just want to introduce some other listeners to the program, Stuart, so stay with me.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark
on ABC Radio.
And if you've just joined us after the footy, my guest is Stuart Kells. This is Nightlife. We're talking about finance and money. It's head-bending stuff, I know, because it turns out money doesn't really exist, it seems. Just to continue that, line of questioning, though, Stuart, about governments say to us all the time, state governments in particular, so I think you're speaking just from Victoria, they say all the time, well, we can't afford to build that train line because we simply don't have money, they use that word, for it in the budget. But you say that's just fictitious, that they could create that out of, can they create it out of thin air?
You're going into a different territory there when you're talking about subnational governments. So the situation at the state level is quite different to the situation at the national level. So hitherto we've been really talking about the RBA and the consolidated federal government. At the state level, it is more like how you imagine. So they're collecting money, it goes into an account, and then they spend it. There are you know, transfers with the federal government and other sorts of complications. But at the state level, it is different.
So state governments are like households. They've got money and they, you know.
More like that,
they have to do a budget. But the federal government, there's no excuse whatsoever. They can simply create any amount of money they want.
You still need a discipline on that money creation, as I said before. And at the moment, the way we do it is we think of the RBA quite separate to the government, the executive branch of government, and we think of those two things as sources of money as quite separate from private bank money creation. But ultimately, they're all operating under this inflation constraint. So we do need disciplines on money creation, and that's one of the reasons why in my work I've emphasised the importance of taking a consolidated view of the whole of the federal government as an economic entity, which includes the RBA, and also thinking about fiscal policy and monetary policy together. At the moment, we tend to think of them quite separately, and there isn't really very good transparency around how the RBA operates. And a good example of that, just very, very quickly, all of those exchange settlement account funds that are sitting with the banks, these are the reserves that are sitting in banks, we as taxpayers pay interest on those, and very large amounts of interest, like in the, you know, in the billions of dollars, in a way that doesn't have the same kind of scrutiny of money that's spent through the normal federal budget, right, for example. So having a more holistic view will allow us to, you know, think differently around flows, where taxpayers' money's going, how do the private banks benefit, and how do we operate within this inflation constraint? Because we're essentially optimising where money comes from and what money is spent on, and not all forms of money creation are the same, right? So some types of government money creation for, you know, infrastructure purposes or for social welfare purposes arguably can be better than some forms of private bank money creation that are driving essentially, you know, asset price bubbles and things like that.
Garth has texted again, my head's spinning and I used to work in a bank. If the loans are created out of thin air, what's the point of funding? Why would banks bother with the hassle of taking deposits in the first place?
It's a really good question. There's a few different reasons why they take deposits. Obviously, sometimes they do bring these exchange settlement account funds, which is kind of useful. It's usually a condition of their banking licenses and their regulation.
What, that they have to take deposits?
That they have to take them. And also, it's important just for, you know, full service provision and
relationships. But in theory, you could have a bank that operated quite profitably just by lending money. That's all they did.
Well, not just quite profitably, extremely profitably. So much so that we would probably have to tax them differently. But 100%, this is something that...
Taking deposits, in other words, is annoying for them.
Taking deposits is annoying. They're an annoying nuisance. And we could have deposit-only institutions, including credit risk-free deposit-only institutions.
Let's keep talking about that. I know this is interrupting our conversation, but it is fascinating. We have to welcome some other listeners too. And then we shall have our entire national audience listening to this actually gripping conversation.
Everyone's sort of frowning.
This is Nightlife with Phil Clark.
On ABC Radio.
Welcome to Nightlife. We are talking about banking, and some of the things we are discussing will bend your head. Certainly, your understanding of money and finance, I think, if it hasn't changed already, I'd be surprised. Brian is on the line. My guest is Stuart Kells, who's an adjunct professor at La Trobe University's College of the Arts, Social Science and Commerce. He's written a fascinating book called Alice, about the banking system, and we'll get to that in a moment. If you've got a call, if you've got a question, now's the time. 1-300-800-222. Brian from Perth. G'day, Brian.
Yeah, how are you going, Phil and Stuart? I'm glad you said that, Phil, because I'm flabbergasted. Well,
so am I.
look, my question is, you know, in the olden days, way, way back, with my very limited economic studies, I assumed that the Reserve Bank of Australia had to back every other bank in Australia. So for every dollar that was, invested, there had to be an equivalent dollar stored somewhere.
Correct.
And I presume also with Fort Knox that it would be some sort of embedded in some sort of gold bullion somewhere.
I reckon everyone thinks that, Brian. I reckon everyone thinks that. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. So, and in the process of listening in the interim, there's another question that comes up, and what's the influence of shareholders, which are quite important in terms of banking? And if they're not happy in a bank, they pull their money out, the bank doesn't exist anymore. I hope they're all happy with their bank shares.
Well, the bank shares are doing very well. They're making a mozza at the moment, and they have been for the last few years. So, yes, you're right, and Phil's right, that people think what you said is true. And it goes back to this idea of what is money, right? Mm. So a large part of money is this bank deposit money, and it's not the same as coins, for example. It doesn't persist. It's really just an entry in a bank's account. And these things are used for payments, and they're settled using these special RBA balances. But there is no stock of money either in your account or corresponding elsewhere that sort of sits behind the depositness of the money. There is, as I said, there's this tier of settlement units, which are extremely important in the system. This sort of, I think of them as like almost like gold. They're a type of bank gold, but they only stay in the banking system. You can't hold them if you're not a bank or you're not a central bank. But yeah, that idea of the vault and RBA standing behind each dollar is not correct.
It's rubbish.
Well, I wouldn't be. Yeah.
So, I mean, can we say this, Stuart? For most purposes, apart from bullion, I mean, apart from notes and cash, mm-hmm. and I'm just thinking whether that even exists, actually, because that's really just a promise by the government to pay you, isn't it, if you tender it. But anyway, just putting that aside for a moment, or trying to think about that for a moment. But apart from that, almost everything that we consider to be money, money in banks, loans, all of this, deposits and loans, it doesn't actually exist.
Think about this in terms of currency, right? Think about it in terms of the Australian dollar. Right? I say I have a quantity of Australian dollars. What does that actually mean? Or I have a quantity of US dollars, right? Mm. If you think about it in terms of bank account money, it doesn't really mean much at all. The thing it means most, the most meaningful part of it in Australia, is the tax office will take Australian dollar denominated accounts and balances for your tax burden, right? So they'll recognise payments out of an Australian dollar account to pay tax. That's what really defines the quote Australian dollars. But other than that, you don't actually have a thing called Australian dollars. You just have an Australian dollar denominated balance. There are no quote Australian dollars. And so when you come to the foreign exchange market and say, I want to swap a quantity of Australian dollars for a quantity of US dollars, their bank accounts are just as hollow as ours. And so what really happens is it's a transaction in these central bank units, these settlement account units. They're the things that have the real value at that moment, and none of us can hold them directly, and they don't come anywhere near us private citizens, individuals. They're only held in the banking system and among central banks. So a lot of these sort of ideas in finance, like fractional reserve banking, the foreign exchange market, bank runs, they're all very intuitive and they are ubiquitous, but they are really just stories that have no grounding in reality.
Deborah. Hello, Deborah.
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I'm just wondering if they don't want our money, deposits, but they want 5% deposit on a house loan. I don't understand that.
Well, it's a really good point, because a lot of this is about the biases in the financial system towards housing and mortgage lending and other forms of lending. There are inherent structural biases in how the banks are regulated and how they operate that tends to send money towards housing, not so much housing construction, but housing purchases, and also things like private equity, which may not be socially the best destination for the money. So one of the things we need to think about once we have this better understanding of money and how we create money within this inflation constraint is what's a better profile of money creation, and what are some better ways to focus lending.
Yeah, equity is what it's about, I reckon.
Thanks, Deb. Okay, just push this a bit further, though, Stuart. I mean, I get that at a bank level, right? I get what you're saying. I find it kind of appalling in a way, but maybe I shouldn't. What about at another level, though? Once upon a time, we all used to get paid in cash.
Correct.
We used to get an envelope full of actual cash.
Yes.
That money went round. That was money in the system. I mean, that was real, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It was. It was. It was real in a physical sense, and it also had a backing of government. And if you went and paid your taxes with it, then the ATO would take it, and everyone would accept it as payment in the way that people accept bank account money now.
There could be a system of money where the money actually existed.
Well, you're getting into interesting territory there, right? Because I think, as you and I have touched on previously, there's this whole world of digital currencies and cryptocurrencies and so on.
I'm going to get there in a moment. Don't worry, people.
Brent. Well, just very quickly, though, some of those currencies do have that thingness, that persistence of money that people assume ordinary money has, right? Mm-hmm. But it doesn't. And so moving towards things like central bank digital currencies and possibly some of the cryptocurrencies could create the kind of banking system in some ways that we assume exists but doesn't.
So that's right. I mean, let's do that. Let's make this point now then. So Bitcoin, for example, is really trying to create something that doesn't exist anyway. That is, it's trying to reinforce in you a belief that there is a real thing called money, which is it's not actually a physical property, it's nearly a physical property because I've got the codes in my hand and that's good enough for my Bitcoin holding. But you're saying that this is an extraordinarily old-fashioned idea and that's not how money works anyway. And then
that's right.
And in the modern world, this has never been how money works, that Bitcoin is simply, we're almost back to a kind of barter system. You know, I've got so much Bitcoin, I'll give you some for something else.
Yeah, Bitcoin itself, most of the cryptocurrencies are instruments of chaos and often instruments of fraud. But the concept of digital currency, including ones backed by the central bank, could actually be quite promising because you could end up with a financial system that operates kind of how it should, right? So, for example, banks have a quantity of these units, and they make judgments about how to lend them based on creditworthiness and things like that. And they do that without some of the systemic risks that exist at the moment. So the whole field of digital currencies is quite legitimate. But a lot of the crypto stuff is essentially just fraud. But just very, very quickly, the anthropology and the language in this area is really interesting, right? You think about banks, remember the Commonwealth Bank, bank tins where we used to put our coins in the bank?
Yeah.
And you look at the front of the old banks and it's very solid and you've got this idea of vaults. And you think about the language of Bitcoin, it's got the word coin in it, and cryptocurrencies has got the word currency in it. It's all about maintaining some of these false beliefs.
Rob is texted in. He says, I just turned on the radio. I am a retired bank CEO. Okay. Your guest is talking rubbish. If a bank lends you $100, it has to have that $100 to give you. It gets that $100 from either deposits or capital. Banks can't lend money they don't have. You're saying that's just not true.
Correct.
Yeah. Rob, the evidence seems to be otherwise, Rob. Rob, if you ran your bank like that, then more power to your arm. But that's not how banks seem to work. You're saying, more importantly, it's not how governments work either. I think we kind of understand that these days, don't we? In the old days when we received political homilies from federal government treasurers saying we've all got to tighten our belts, there's no money, we need to tax more. This all creates this false belief that there is a pot of money which the government has each year and like Scrooge McDuck rolls around in it and then doles out. But you're saying at least at a federal government level, that's just not true. The government has to be careful about what it spends because of inflationary issues and debt issues that it may create, which become impossible to service. But
the debt part,
it always has the money. It never not has the money.
If you're a monetarily sovereign country like Australia is, and New Zealand and Sweden and Japan and a bunch of other countries, you can always, through the central bank, create new money. But there are limits around inflation, as you said, and also for a smaller country, there are limits in relation to the exchange rate too, right? So that we can't just infinitely create money. So going back to your tax question, there is no structural constraint, which means that the government has to raise money that in order to spend money, right? So it doesn't have to have a positive balance in the Treasury general account. It could, in principle, go negative. We, as a contrivance, maintain this rule that the Treasury general account can't go into negative balance, which means that if the tax is not enough to cover all the spending, we have to borrow. But the borrowing happens at essentially a commercial rate of interest. So the borrowing is an artifact of that contrivance of this internal budget constraint. It's not structural. It's just some sort of rule that we've imposed on ourselves. But it leads down, you know, think about the US and the level of borrowing there. Hmm. It's this vast debt burden, really, to operate within that somewhat artificial, entirely artificial budget constraint, when really what matters is, as I said, the inflation constraint and the money creation constraint.
Hmm. Talking with Stuart Kells, he's written a fascinating book called Alice, The Biggest Untold Story in the History of Money, which is about another matter which we should talk about at some point. But there's some very interesting ruminations in this book on the world financial system, which will do your head in, quite frankly, if you thought, as I did, that banks needed money to lend. They don't, and they lend money they don't have all the time. In fact, what you think of as money, it doesn't really bear any resemblance to what money is. Graham from Perth. Sorry, Graham, you've been waiting on there. Hello.
Hello, Philip and Stuart. My question is, are building societies and credit societies at greater risk than a bank?
That's a really good question. In the US recently, we had a little bit of a series of smaller banks failing. They were almost driven in a traditional way, like an old-fashioned bank run. People lost confidence in the bank and they took their money out, right? But as I emphasized before, in today's system, with this two-tier system of ESAs and ordinary deposits, a shortage of deposits or an outflow of deposits as deposits is not a problem. So these banks can all lose their deposits and continue to have their asset side of the balance sheet, which is separate, quarantined from the deposit side. So the risk is that they don't have these ESAs. Now, in an emergency, the central bank can step in and say, well, we'll give you enough ESAs to cover the outflow. The bank's actually in clover, because if the deposits all go, they're an expensive nuisance and you ended up with just the assets, right? So what's happened in the US is people have misunderstood what's driving these failures, but the big banks, the very big banks, have come in and said, well, this is fantastic because I can pretend that these are failing and distressed banks and I can buy them for pennies in the dollar, which is exactly what's happened. So this has been this incredible flow of capital towards the very big banks as they've picked up these smaller banks because they've failed for reasons that they really shouldn't have led to a failure. So if you've got an agile central bank, then all of these banks are fine. And as a community, we don't want a situation where all of the banking is essentially concentrated in these mega big city banks, because you don't get small town lending, you don't get the different kinds of less profitable, less glamorous lending that, you know, banks like, I don't want to name anyone in particular, but the biggest Wall Street banks don't care what happens in some of the small towns or the small cities. And likewise, to a degree, I guess, in Australia as well, that regional communities get a bit of short shrift if there's this consolidation of banks. So it's in our interest to have some smaller banks, including NBFIs and building societies and things. And if we've got an agile and intelligent central bank, they should be very secure.
Mm. Okay, thank you, Graham. Someone's texted me in a very succinct summary of what we're saying. It's amazing how some bankers don't understand how the fractional reserve system works. They say, if you borrow money from a bank, you borrow it into existence.
That's correct.
Which is correct. This is what you're saying.
And when you pay your taxes, you pay it into oblivion.
Into oblivion. Into oblivion. Right. Yep. So if that's right, if you pay your tax bill, you tax the money into oblivion because it never existed as such in the first place.
Paying taxes is compulsory money destruction, and government borrowing is voluntary money destruction.
Oh, boy.
So we need to change our language.
Why don't we go back to the barter system? Keith asks a pertinent question, Keith, because I've already had this idea ahead of you. So go on.
Yeah, one of the proofs that we've got that what your guest is saying is correct is if, say, you wanted to borrow $100,000, and what people generally think is 1,000 people with $100 in their bank would lose that money because it's been lent
to someone. Yeah.
So that obviously doesn't happen, because when a bank makes a loan to somebody, you don't see your account balance drop down.
No,
correct.
But the question I really have is, what stops me starting a bank?
Correct, Keith. I'm already ahead of you on this, Keith. I'm getting the documentation sorted already. Most of the best jobs in my bank have gone, Keith, but you might get one. Do you want one?
Well, I've been studying how to start a bank for a while.
Please include me, guys. I want to be in on that as well.
This is a fundamental question, though, Stuart. Is this simply a matter of regulation that the government won't let you start a bank? Is that it?
It's relatively easy to get a banking license. There's a process that you need to go through, but there's quite a few banks in Australia. There's a lot of smaller banks. There's, you know, banks that are sort of $100 million or a little bit bigger than that, but they're not huge. I know $100 million, what's that between friends? Mm-hmm. But in banking terms, that's not a lot of money. If you look at lists of Australian banking licenses, there are quite a few smaller ones, online ones. And, you know, they're making a mozza because they're getting paid by us on all these reserves that they're holding. They're benefiting from all that government borrowing, which arguably is unnecessary, or at least it's overly expensive. They're providing a lot of that capital into that as well, and you know, earning rents and all sorts of things from that. So being a banker is extremely attractive, and they've got more money than they can actually spend, which is why they have these vast salaries, why they have incredible profits. And one of the things that you need to think about with the financial system is the financial system the right size? Are we as a community rewarding the services and risks that they're taking and providing? And the short answer is it's over large at the moment. We're allocating too much of our resources to this set of services, which, as we've sort of talked about, is not as complicated or as risky as we might have thought. So one of the conversations that I'm trying to encourage and open up is, how do we right-size the financial system, and how do we address some of the other risks in the financial system, like some of the gambles that the institutions take?
So what's a better way to think about money then? What do you say we should do? What's a better way to think about it?
Well, I really like that idea that we touched on a little bit before of credit risk-free, deposit-only institutions. So why?
So banks should be divided up. There should be banks that just lend money and banks that just take deposits and pay interest.
Well, there's a lot to be said for that, because it takes a lot of the systemic risk out of the system. So going back to the GFC you mentioned in your opening, you know, that really showed that there's this sort of endogenous risk creation. All of the problems in the GFC were really driven by the banking system. Wasn't a natural disaster, wasn't a war, no. It was the risks and the problems in banking, right?
Hang on. If a bank's just taking deposits and paying interest, how does a bank make money there? They're lending that money to someone else, are they? How do you make money out of that?
Well, if they're taking deposits and lending, then they're not a deposit-only or a lending-only bank. There's a series of different ways that could work. One of the ways is by having interest on the exchange settlement account balances that they have, which aren't
money.
And
they earn money from that.
Yeah, but also, yeah, you might have a situation where if it's credit risk-free, it might be a very low interest rate. And on the other side, if you have one that's lending-only, then you might have a higher rate of taxation, for example, because it's, you know, extremely profitable because they don't actually have to pay for deposits.
Hmm.
So these are the sorts of conversations that we can have, and these are the sorts of innovations that this opens up.
Here's the thing. A lot of people still wedded to the idea of gold, aren't they? And they think gold's a store of value. Well, in a way it is, but that's only because we've agreed that it's a store of value. It's not inherently a store of value, is it?
Well, if it was a choice between gold and Bitcoin, I'd go for gold because it's a real thing. It's got some sort of utilitarian
value.
We've always liked it. And it's, you know, there's a finite amount of it until we find a golden planet somewhere. And it's a real thing. Like the price will bounce around. But, you know, if I want to settle, a foreign exchange transaction with certain types of countries, sometimes gold can work. Bitcoin is fundamentally fragile. The amount is not limited. It has a sort of that whole field has a fraudulent potential.
I'm sorry, we haven't talked about Alice at all. See, we could talk for hours about this.
I'm really enjoying the conversation.
In that case, good. The book is called Alice, The Biggest Untold Story in the History of Money. And Alice is in part a story about people who thought there might be a better way to organise the system and what happened. It ended up in the Supreme Court. It's essentially, in the end, a patent case, and it can get a bit eye-glazing to go into the detail. But it's not in the book. It's a very, very fascinating human story. Stuart Kells is my guest. Alice is his book, The Biggest Untold Story in the History of Money. David from Creswick says, is all this why Russia hasn't collapsed yet? Well, I suppose that's the answer is yes.
That's right. They can make new rubles.
Yeah. Is what you were saying, we discussed on the program a while back, modern monetary theory. Is this what you're describing?
I think it's a good way to think of it is the work that I'm doing and the work that Ian Shepherd did in relation to Alice. It overlaps with some of modern monetary theory. It's a Venn diagram, and there's a bit of overlap, but there's a fair bit that we don't necessarily buy into MMT, and likewise, some of this is not quite up their alley. But I did a piece that you saw in The Guardian a day or two ago, and that was certainly embraced by a lot of the writers and thinkers in that area. But some of the conclusions that are drawn from the MMT people aren't exactly congruent with what I would say.
But in brief, in 30 seconds or less, why shouldn't the government just borrow as much money as they can and build all the high-speed trains and tunnels and infrastructure we need?
Well, we do need to rebalance, as I said, the sources of money creation more towards essential infrastructure. But in all of these decisions, they have to be allocatively efficient and technically efficient. There's no money tree. We do have to have fiscal and monetary restraint, and as a community make decisions about where to allocate money. So none of this means that money is meaningless. None of it means that there's an infinite supply of money. It just means we need to think more holistically about the fiscal side and the monetary side together, and then think about public sector money creation and private sector money creation as different parts underneath the same inflation umbrella.
Okay, this idea of that there's a money box and there's only a certain amount in it, and money goes in and money comes out is not so. Sorry, everyone. I know. I had the same reaction when I read the book as well. Stuart, we've got to go. we'll leave everyone to think about all this. But thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, Phil. It was great.
Thank you. Stuart Kells is the author of Alice, The Biggest Untold Story in the History of Money. Makes your head hurt, doesn't it?
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.